Okay, so the first thing is, thank you all for coming tonight.
You're welcome.
I guess I should, I'm not going to take it yet. Thank you all for coming tonight. Reuven Aschenberg has informed me that it is the yurt site of?
Grandmother.
His grandmother, Chaya Leah Bas Yaakov Dov. So tonight's learning is Ilui Nishmas, Chaya Leah Bas Yaakov Dov. Just to give a quick introduction from Rabbi Goldberger. Rabbi Goldberger is the Morad Astra of Knesset Israel in Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And I met him there on a number of occasions because I've had Schlapper concerts there. And just introduce what you're going to hear for 2 minutes. So I have had an album called Shabbos in Liverpool, or Shabbat in Liverpool, that I took 27 Beatles songs and I put them to Shabbos Tefillah. And at the end of finishing the album, 5 years ago, the engineer told me that I needed permission, that I wasn't going to be able to release this album. And I went to my entertainment lawyer, and lo and behold, I needed permission from the estate of John Lennon and from Sir Paul McCartney in order to release the album. And on June 16th, 2008, 4 years after I had done the album, so Paul McCartney's lawyer said no. So this album was dead in the water. And then I came to Minneapolis on November 8th, and Rabbi Goldberger was there. He was the one that brought me to Minneapolis. And he said to me, so why hasn't your Beatles album come out? And I said, because God said no. Because God doesn't want it to come out. Because the lawyers of Sir Paul McCartney don't want it to come out. It's not coming out. He said to me, no. He said, you don't want it to come out. You have put barriers. He didn't say it like that. He didn't scream at me. He said, you have put barriers in front of this album. It's not that God doesn't want to come out. This album come out. You don't want it to come out. So he did the six steps of Amunah, the six steps of Amunah with a bitachon, sorry, six steps of bitachon with me. Within 1 month, I got licensing for the album, and the album will be coming out in August. It took 5 years. And so when Rabbi Goldberger came to Israel for a couple of weddings, and I met with him on Thursday. His trip was extended. He'll tell you why if he wants to. His trip was extended. I asked him if he wanted to do a shiur on Saturday night, and he said yes. And so that's how I will bring you into the six steps of Emunah. Here's Rabbi Goldberger.
Thank you very much. As Lenny said, I am from Minnesota, where frozen food means something different from what it means everywhere else. But I want to begin by thanking the Solomons for opening up their home this evening and wishing you a very happy birthday, Lenny.
Thank you.
Lenny has a lot of fans in Minnesota, myself included, and it's been a delight to get to know him, particularly through the process of studying Bitachon with him. Let me tell you a little bit about what caused me to be interested in teaching this subject the way I do. It's not my rabbinate. I do a lot of speaking as a rabbi, but it was really from a sideline, and that was teaching a group of 7th and 8th graders. I was asked 1 year to teach a group of 7th and 8th graders, and the topic was the book Mesilat Yesharim, The Path of the Just. And if any of you are familiar with Mesilat Yesharim, it's not an easy thing to make appealing to a group of 7th grade boys. And I was trying to figure out how I could do it, and I hit upon the thing that always fascinated me about the book. And if you're familiar with it, it is, there's a roadmap, and it's rungs in a ladder of spiritual development. Torah leads to watchfulness leads to zeal, and it goes up and up. And the highest two rungs on the ladder, there's Kedusha, holiness, and holiness leads to Ruach HaKodesh, to divine inspiration, and divine inspiration leads to Tehiyas HaMeisim, to resurrection of the dead. So I looked at the class and I said, I have a book to study with you. It's going to teach you how you can raise the dead. And they looked at me with wide eyes and they said, you're going to teach us that? And I said, yes, I'm going to teach it to you. It's right here in the book. Now, of course, anyone who has studied Mesilas Yesharim knows that it's a while. You have to go through it, and it takes a while. You go through it slowly. And as I was going through it, I decided not to read it out of order. Sometimes, you know, you read the last chapter first. I decided I wasn't going to do that because I thought it might not work if I didn't get all the steps. And so when I first studied it, I went through it chapter by chapter, and it took me near the end until I realized there were no chapters on Ruach HaKodesh or on Tehillat HaNitzim. So I figured, like, the idea was once you get up to holiness, you'll figure out the rest on your own. But I managed to make it a class in which by the end of the class, they insisted that I was going to be able to show them by the end how to do it. I won't tell you how I did it, because tonight's topic is not Miss Leslie Shorin, but suffice it to say that my seventh graders were satisfied with the explanation I gave them by the end. And it got me thinking that if I was able to excite myself and excite those kids so much with that approach, that's because we have a craving for the reality of what we are taught. So when I began to think about bitachon, bitachon, if it works, is absolutely fascinating. It means that you can rely on God. Literally, if you take it seriously, do no work or little work or a measured amount of work and have all your needs provided to you. And what do most of us worry about more than anything? Parnasa, parnasa, how are we going to make a living? What are we going to do? And here we have this thing called bitachon that supposedly is going to provide us our needs. Wow! Raise the dead! Fascinating! But I have to find a way to make it clear, to make it work. And so this is a quest, a personal quest that began with me years ago when I was coming out of high school and looking at the options I had in my life ahead of me, and particularly when I made my first visit to Eretz Yisrael, when I realized that there were people who actually live on bitachon. They, you know, what's the percentage? It's in Jerusalem, over 65% of the people just don't work. They just don't work. They don't have jobs. There are families. But their trademark is, we've gone four generations, we haven't had a job. No one in this family has worked. Well, how do you do it? Oh, Hashem provides. I mean, I've heard that, but how do you really do it? And I was one of those curious kind of guys. I wanted to know how they did it. How do you know? I understand the concept. It makes a lot of sense. Trust in God. God's all powerful. He'll provide. But, you know, you have a rent check due on Thursday. How do you practically make sure you have the money to pay for it? I didn't understand, and I wanted to understand. So I was here for my, you know, year in yeshiva after high school, and I made it my mission to try to find out how they do it. And I would ask people, and they wouldn't tell me. Nobody would tell me how it was done. And I kept on asking. I just insisted to myself that I've got to find this out before I leave this country. And finally, after bugging a lot of people, I got one respected mechanech in Jerusalem to call me, tell me if I came back at a certain time, he would talk to me about the topic, and he wouldn't give me the whole answer, but he would give me Rashi Prakim, he would give me a couple of details, and if I could intuit the entire picture from what he told me, then it would be mine. And otherwise, he wasn't going to give me any more details. Well, that was the best offer I had, so I picked him up on it, and all he showed me was a passage in a sefer called Beit HaLevi that I'll share with you tonight as part of my presentation. And I was on my own. So I understood, I got a sense of where I thought he was going with it. And I went back to the States. For a while I was running a business to keep myself afloat while I was learning as much as I could. And I would test theories. And I would try out my theories in the business that I was running. And over, I would say, about 8 years, I put together what I call the six steps of bitachon. And most fascinatingly, I found that it worked. And I just refined it. Over the years, I've refined it more and more until I feel confident enough to do what I did with Lenny, which is basically tell him, you use the system, you will get your needs met. And I say that with the same confidence to all of you tonight. I will explain to you what the six steps are. I'll give you a little bit of background so you'll understand what premises it's built on. And then I'll tell you how you can make use of it in your lives if you're interested. I'm going to tell you why you should be interested. The main reason why you should be interested is because I think bitachon has been presented unclearly. I'll try to be generous. Most of the time when bitachon is discussed, it's discussed as a level, a spiritual level that a person can reach. And we're told that if you're on a certain level of spirituality, you can rely on God. Otherwise, you have to work. But even when you work, you're supposed to rely on God. The idea is that although I'm working for a living, it's God who's providing. So when I go to work and my boss writes me a paycheck, it's true, but he is just the shaliach, he's just the agent, it is God who is providing my income, and that's the way I'm supposed to understand it. Which always left me unsatisfied, because it's nice to say that, but in fact, it's my boss who's writing the check. So, if you know, and I would be nervous if my boss told me that I was fired one day. So who's going to provide it the next? Now, there is a story that's told about Rebbe Zisha, the Hasidisha Rebbe Zisha, who used to come home from shul every morning, and it was time for breakfast, and he would sit down at his breakfast table, and he would raise his hands to Shemayim, and he would say, "Tate, Zisha is hungry." Well, that was the cue for his, not his wife, I guess it was his assistant who worked in the kitchen, to bring him his breakfast. So she brought him his breakfast every morning after she heard him say, "Tate Zusha is hungry." And of course she began to think, you know, this is a little ridiculous. Tate is not bringing him his breakfast, I'm bringing him his breakfast. Let me see what happens if one day I don't. So she decided the next morning when he called for breakfast, she was just going to stay in the kitchen and not bring it out to him. So sure enough, he wakes up the next morning, he goes to shul, he comes home, and he sits at his table, "Tate, Zusha is hungry." And she doesn't move. And within seconds, there's a knock at the door. Zusha goes to open the door. There's a neighbor. She says, "Zusha, I saw how you woke up early this morning and cleared the snow away for my father to get to shul. I was so grateful, I decided I had to do something for you. I decided to make you breakfast." So the chastened assistant in the kitchen learned a lesson about bitachon. But what I felt that I could do effectively was quantify what bitachon is about, primarily because I don't believe that bitachon is a level. I don't think that it is limited to people who have attained high achievements in spirituality. I believe, and I think I can demonstrate, that bitachon is a mitzvah. It is one of the tariag, one of the 613 mitzvot, and we are obligated to live our lives with bitachon. There was a time when we did, when we all naturally lived according to bitachon, and I'm referring to Adam and Chava living in the Garden of Eden. And what bitachon meant was God provided your needs. Now, when you had a need in the Garden of Eden, what did you do? Our sages tell us that there were finished goods that were available on the trees in the garden. If you wanted a loaf of bread, you know, we say hamotzi lechem min haaretz. God provides bread from the ground. We don't say that God provides grain from the ground and we turn it into bread. We say God provides bread because initially that's what happened. You would go to a bread tree and you would pluck off the bread. In fact, they say that there is a tree in, you've heard this, in Southeast Asia. I think it's called the breadfruit tree because the fruit actually resembles a loaf of bread. I've seen it somewhere.
There's a tree that has,
they
look like
challah. They look like challah. And it's suggested that this is done so that we can appreciate that there was a time when this is what you would do. You would pluck fully finished food products from the trees and clothing and whatever you need. Your needs were made available to you. But we got in the way. Adam Arishon, mankind sinned, it was thrown out of the Garden of Eden and pushed further away from this system. But the system never left us entirely. And I'll give you an illustration. We now have to work for our bread because the earth was cursed. But if you think about it, we have basic needs other than just bread. We all have a need for oxygen. How hard do we have to work? Unless a person is, God forbid, sick, a person doesn't really have to work to get the oxygen, which is a basic need. For the most part, we don't have to work that hard to get water. Water is more or less readily available. And you'll notice that both of them do not come from the earth. The earth was cursed. And so the sense of having to work for a living is really about working for bread. But in the world of air, in the world of water, there's still, for the most part, a sense that we rely on God and He provides it. Everything ought to be that way. All of our needs should be that way. Except we got in the way because we said to Hashem, you know what? We don't really want that kind of close relationship. We feel like we need to do something to contribute to it. So God says, okay, that's what you want. Go ahead. Out of the garden, now you're going to have to work. But that was our request. God is no less interested in providing this our needs. So Bitachon says, rely on me because I'm going to provide for your needs. So we said, okay, but we want to feel that we're doing something too. So God said, okay, your role will be to do some effort. And this effort is what we call hishtadlus. Hishtadlus means effort. So now there's a dance. The dance is that God says, I'm going to provide you your needs unilaterally. But because you requested to have something to do with it, you're going to have to do some effort called hishtadlus. Now the two don't have to meet. It isn't because of your hishtadlus or directly related to your hishtadlus that you're getting the need. You're getting the need because you have the need. You're doing the hishtadlus because you said you wanted to do some hishtadlus. So now you have to do hishtadlus, and then I'll give you the need. But the two can operate on non-parallel tracks. They just have to both take place. What's involved in the six steps, then, is A, the identifying of our need, B, the clarifying that it is something that we will have to do hishtadlus for, C, determining how much hishtadlus we're going to have to do. Now, a formula can only be valuable if it's going to be precise. If I'm going to walk away from the formula with a muddy idea of what I'm supposed to be doing, it doesn't give me much. And so I knew that this formula for it to be effective was going to have precision outcomes, where I would need to be able to know exactly how much effort that I needed to do in order to qualify for God to give me my needs. Now, this is where the passage from the Beit HaLevi became valuable. The passage was from Parshat Miketz, from the Parsha of Miketz, the story of Yosef. We all know that Yosef was punished by having to stay 2 years extra in prison because of what?
He asked for help.
Now, the obvious question is, aren't you supposed to ask for help? If hishtadlus is required, Yosef is not living in the Garden of Eden, so he should have to put in some effort. So he does put in effort. He goes to the butler. He says, can you please remember your power? So God says, I shouldn't have done it. Now you're going to be punished, stay in jail 2 extra years. How do we understand that? The Beis HaLevi's comment is as follows. He said, really, Yosef knew that God was going to get him out of jail. He was certain that God was going to get him out of jail. He had the kind of certainty that the Beis HaLevi refers to as hashkatat rucho v'libo, an absolute tranquility of spirit. He wasn't even troubled. He didn't even think twice. Did any of us express a concern over our next breath of air? We need it. We all know that in theory God could produce some oxygen-eating bacteria and just take our oxygen away in the next few seconds before we can get our next breath of air. He could do that. It's theoretically possible. But we don't have any anxiety about it. Yosef had no anxiety over the fact that God was going to take him out of jail. He knew that he was there for a reason. God brought him there. God's going to bring him out. For such a person, hishtadlus is wrong. Hishtadlus is actually forbidden. If you have complete and utter serenity that you are going to receive this particular need, whatever need it is that we're discussing, and you do effort anyway, you're going to be punished for it. Because why are you doing effort? If you know that God's going to give it to you, then you shouldn't be doing anything at all. And that was the message to Yosef. You're going to be punished for 2 years because your efforts suggest that you don't really have enough belief in this system, because he had the necessary tranquility. So this is what I got from the teacher in Yerushalayim.
So why did he do it?
It was a failure in Emunah, which is different from Bitachon. Now,
but we're not supposed to rely on miracles.
You're not relying on miracles when you don't do any effort before taking your next breath. What you're relying on is certainty. When you have a feeling of certainty, it's in any relationship. If you know that your friend is going to remember to pick up the challahs that you didn't get to go to because you didn't get to get to the store that day, if you know that they are so aware of your need and they're so concerned with your welfare that they're going to do it, then why are you calling them to ask them? That would actually be impolite, because you know they're going to think of you. You know they're going to remember. That's relying not on a miracle, that's relying on certainty.
What about a pray? Is that called hishtadlus?
Possibly not. Possibly not, because if prayer is a hushtablos, which in many cases it can be, for a need, it very well would be. I'm going to distinguish between a need and a want. For wants, you should pray. For needs, over which you have absolute serenity, if you do, we'll discuss how to get there, you don't even pray. That would be a lack of emunah. Now let me just clarify the difference between emunah and bitachon, and then we'll get into the six steps. Very often we hear them sort of thrown out in a jumble. Emunah, bitachon, Chazon Ish's book on the subject is called Emunah uBitachon. Many books written, I kind of mixed the two together. I think it's very important to separate them. Emunah is faith in God. Bitachon is reliance on God. And the difference is, Emunah calls upon us to whatever awareness, whatever understanding we have of God, to make it real. So if we understand who God is, let's live that way. So Yosef, who understood that God was someone upon whom you could rely if you felt serenity, should have lived that way. And that's why he was punished for doing the extra effort, because he knew that to be true about God. He didn't live it at that particular moment. Bitachon is something different. Bitachon is, I'm relying on him. Now, if these are both mitzvahs, where are these mitzvahs in the Torah? Which of the 613 mitzvahs? Where's the mitzvah of Emunah? Where's the mitzvah of Bitachon?
Anochi Hashem.
Anochi Hashem Elokecha is often quoted, the first commandment, is often quoted as the source for which mitzvah?
Emunah.
Emunah. Now, very often it'll be quoted as the catch-all source for Emunah and Bitachon. But I think it's mistaken. It is the source for the mitzvah of Emunah. I am the Lord your God, which basically means I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. So when you think about who was it who just got me out, be real, it was me. That's what the first commandment is telling us. Bitachon, I think, is also in the Ten Commandments. But it's not the first. Anybody want to try? Which commandment is Bitachon?
Shabbat?
Not Shabbat.
Three.
It's the second commandment. It's the second. Which makes sense. If Emunah is the first, Bitachon is the second. How is it the second commandment? I thought the second commandment was, you shall have no other gods before me. Well, think about it. Why do people have other gods?
They don't believe in the first one.
I don't think it's because they don't believe in the first one. I think that there is an anxiety that people feel. You know, by nature, man has needs. And by nature, man is not able to provide for his own needs. We have to use something. We can't guarantee that we're going to have, from within ourselves, that we're going to have what we need tomorrow. So what do? We rely on something. So for the person who relies on his job at the factory, if he really believes that it's the job at the factory that's providing him his income, that is a form of avodah zarah, is it not? If you have a Harvard degree, and so you go through life thinking, I'll be okay because I have a degree from Harvard. Well, God has his, you know, kind of a sense of humor. He has a way of making Harvard degrees become worthless just when you're planning to rely on it the most. To remind us that it's not the Harvard degree, that could be your hishtaglos, that could be a tool, but that's not what you're relying on. When a person relies on something other than God, that is avodah zarah. The commandment, the second commandment is, when you have reason to rely, and you will, because you will have needs, don't let it be on anything other than God. Don't let your reliance be on all of the tools that God may or may not use. Let it be on God himself. Which means that the mitzvah of don't have any other gods before me is the mitzvah of bitachon. And it, to me, it couldn't be more logical. That's the background. What are the six steps? So, again, the purpose is to clarify what my needs are. Let me just take one more small detour. How do we know that if I have a need, God is going to provide?
1 + 1 = 2.
Let's say he might give it to me, or he might not, which in many works on Bitachon you'll hear. You trust that he'll do what's best for you. So that means if you don't get it, whoever wrote the book has already given himself an out. Well, obviously if you didn't get it, it's because God felt it wasn't the best for you, which is, I think, how most of us walk away from the discussion of Bitachon. But in fact, God said, if you have needs, I'll provide them for you. Where does he say it? He says it in a pasuk. The pasuk, it's you can open up your sitter, and at the end of Aleinu, there's a small paragraph. It starts, Alti Rami Pachad Pidon. And in that paragraph, there's a phrase that says, Ani Asiti V'Ani Esa. Which means, if you take God at His word, I created and I will sustain. Which means, to my ears, I will take care of anything I created, whatever the needs are. And we see He does that in the natural world. He's created all these creatures who somehow manage to know how to find their way to their food. I will sustain what I've created. Well, there's no reason why that shouldn't apply to us. So He's told us that He's going to give us our needs. Okay, well, what's the next obvious question? I may think it's a need, but what if God doesn't agree? So how can I rely on it in a real way when, you know, again, God has an out. He can always say, well, you know, I didn't think you needed that. You finally needed that. So let's think for a minute. The Torah tells us that God gave us the Torah. Torah lo v'shamayim hi. Torah is not in heaven, which means the Torah has been given to us. We have authority over the Torah. Let me ask you a question. Let's say I buy a chicken in the market, and there's a shayla on the chicken. I'm not sure if it's kosher or non-kosher. I go to the rabbi, and the rabbi rules that it's kosher. How can I eat it? What if God doesn't agree? What if heaven doesn't agree? I'm concerned about what's going to happen to me in heaven if I eat a non-kosher chicken. So the rabbi thinks it's kosher. Well, what if the rabbi's wrong? Torah lo b'shamayim, the Torah is not, which means that if the rabbi decides that in his view it's kosher, then heaven agrees. Heaven goes along. And in heaven, it's even if, in theory, God might have disagreed. And this is a passage in the Talmud. There's a story of Rabbi Eliezer, who once brought all the forces of nature to prove that he was right, but the halakhic process works against the individual in favor of the majority. The majority went against him, and a voice from heaven came and said, you know, Rabbi Eliezer is right, leave him alone, and the halacha didn't follow Rabbi Eliezer. Torah is in our hands, which means you got to follow the logic. That means if we decide that something is a need, doesn't heaven have to accept it? What's the problem?
We're not the majority.
That's true if a question is put to the majority, but what if a question is put to a single posek? My Rav, if I take my chicken to my Rav, even if the majority opposes him, if my rabbi to whom I presented the question says the chicken is kosher, I'm allowed to eat it. But let's say it's not my rabbi. Let's say I know enough about the laws of kosher, and I rule on it on myself, on the chicken. Can I eat it? Yes, because I can be my own posek if I know enough to do so. The only reason why I can't just look at my situation and say, this is my need, therefore I'm going to paskin, I'm going to rule that it's my need, and heaven will accept it, is because, let's face it, we're biased, we're subjective. Therefore, part of the six steps is designed to eliminate the subjectivity. Because if we can do that, we can reach a halachic conclusion, a psak halacha, that defines our need specifically. Once we've done that, the verse says, Ani asiti v'ani asa, I'm going to give you your need. And he might, just like that. Or, as we'll see, he might say, I'm ready to give it to you, but you're not ready for me to give it to you, because you haven't done your hishtadlus yet. And thanks to Adam Arishon, you now feel like you have to do hishtadlus. So we're going to have to figure out how to do that. You're about to see the six steps do exactly what I just described. Let's go through the six steps. Step number one, the starting point is, I've got a need, a particular need, because it's need by need. It's a need by need analysis. So I have a particular need in front of me, something that I currently need. I want to have Hashem provide it. B'tachon says, I'm supposed to rely on Him when I have a need. So now I've got a need in front of me. I need to pay my rent on Thursday. So step one is this my next most immediate need? That's step one. Now why do I ask that first? Again, I think it's logical. Because God has promised to provide our needs. He hasn't provided He hasn't promised to provide them before they are needed. So if today is Monday and I don't have to pay my rent until Thursday, there is no guarantee that he's ever given me that he's going to give me the money on Monday. By Thursday, if that's my need, he has committed himself to giving it to me. So my question is this my next most immediate need? If I have other needs that precede it, it's not time to work out a cheshbon, a calculation for my need for Thursday. But let's say I've done that and there are no other needs that I can envision between now and then. So if it's my next most immediate need, step one is taken care of, I can move to step two. Now step two is one of two steps, two and five, that I can't do alone, because this is where I have subjectivity. Step two is it really a need? Because that's the brass tacks. Is it really a need? If I'm going to have God provide it, it's got to really be a need. Now, there are ways that I can answer the question automatically. I call them four automatics. Number one, if I can find absolute evidence that it is a need, a pasuk in the Torah that says that it's a need, well, that's automatic. If it's a chazal, if it's a passage from the Talmud, that is authoritative, and I can accept that, then heaven will accept it. Yes, it's a need, because I found a passage in the Talmud that says this is something I need. Number three is if I have already a rav, a spiritual mentor, who knows me and who I consult with for questions, who has told me, you know something, Chaim, this is something that you need. Okay, I can accept that. That is the system of approaching a spiritual guide. The fourth automatic is what I call derech ha'olam. If it is normal in my society for this to be a needed thing, then I can assume that I'm no less. I need it also. So my example for this is a car. You need a car. Well, it depends. If you live in Minnesota, you need a car. Everybody in Minnesota has a car. There's no way to get around with that one. You can't walk. It is 32 below zero Fahrenheit. You cannot walk anywhere. You got to have a car. If you live in Brooklyn, not necessarily. It's not a universal need in your society. Brooklyn, a lot of people take the subway everywhere. But if in your society you can make a legitimate case that this is considered a need, there was a time, and it can change. There was a time when a refrigerator was not a universal need. You had an icebox. Well, now a refrigerator is a need. So, except in this.
What was the second automatic?
The second automatic is a chazal, something from the Talmud, a passage in the Talmud. So a pasuk, chazal, your Rebbe having told you this personally, or derech ha'olam. Let's say it's not one of those four. It still might be a need, but you can't develop it as being automatic. So you take a chavruta. You take a partner. And you sit down with your chavrusa and you say, I would like to make a case to you that this is something that I need. I think I need it, but I know that I'm biased and I may be fooling myself. So, Chaim, I am going to present to you what I believe to be my need, and you will have to argue that it's not. You will have to argue that it's just something I want, and want very badly, but I can't honestly call it a need, and then I'll have to respond to you and prove to you, not to your satisfaction that you would consider it a need, but I have to prove to you that I really do consider it a need and that I'm not fooling myself. So to an objective outsider, I have to make a sufficiently strong case that this is truly something that I believe that I need in order for me to be able to issue a psak halakha, which is what we do after step two. After the back and forth, we issue a psak halakha which says, this need that I've identified from step one as my next most immediate is truly a need that I have.
Would this follow for things like finding a shidduch for your child or for health when one is ill?
The answer is yes. The answer is yes, but let me explain to you what you can use bitachon for and what you cannot use bitachon for.
Why aren't those there? Hold on.
They may be. I'm saying that the answer is they could be needs. But let me just clarify quickly. Bitachon can be used for needs that I have in order to live. It's not. I can't use bitachon for the essence of what my life is all about. What I call my avodah Hashem, the life that I lead. is full of projects that I want to undertake. It's full of ambitions that I want to realize. I can't use Bitachon and say, God, you realize my ambitions for me. But if I have ambitions, and in order to realize those ambitions, I need capital. I need peace of mind. I need whatever. There are many things that I need, that logistical needs, physical, material needs. That's what Bitachon can be used for. When it comes to Shidduchim, it's very important to make the following distinction. You can't call finding a shidduch a need, because that is the essence of my life. You can't. I don't have a need to have a relationship. Having a relationship is what I am here to develop. But I can't develop a relationship if I have no one to go out with. That is a need. So in other words, that's a logistical or material need, is a person to meet. Mm-hmm. And once I have a person to meet, then I can proceed to do the avoda, the work of building a relationship. So I can't have God do the relationship building for me. I can't have him do my work for me, but I can have the Bitachon provide me all of the background needs that I'm going to require in order to make that effort.
How does it meet the timing consideration? That has to be the very next need.
The next one that I'm ready to deal with. There comes a time when I sit down, now I'm going to think about finding a soulmate, whatever it might be. And I don't have any other things on my plate right now. This is the most important, most immediate thing that I'm going to be working on. Yes?
Based on what you just said with the Shijab, I'm just trying to understand the differentiation between need and avoda, as you said. So basically, the need is the chomer, the material by which you can fulfill the avoda. So what you're saying is...
By which I can start to work on
the avoda. So what you're saying is that you can't have bitachon for a shidduch, but you can have sort of bitachon that a shadchan will come along with the prospect.
Exactly. So at the end of step two, I issue a psak halacha. And now I have a need that God has to recognize. He committed himself to recognize. Because he said, Ani Asi Divani Nisan. Well, that's great. So where is it? It's a need. I have a need. It's been confirmed. God is committed to providing it. So where is it? Well, it might be right there. Step three, I have to ask myself the question, do I have Hashkatat Rucho Libo for this particular need? Because remember that, and this is the piece from the Beit Halevi, that if you have that feeling, then it is not only not necessary to do Hishtabos, it's forbidden to do Hishtabos. You know that God is going to provide. How do you know? Well, I feel it. I have absolute certainty that God is going to provide it. Okay, so then sit back and you'll see. It will be there.
So let's use a job, for example. Okay, so if you know that Hashem is going to provide you with parnasa because at Rosh Hashanah, so looking for a job would be considered hishtadlus that you shouldn't do?
Let me give you a mashal. This is a famous story, a Hasidic story. The Rebbe has a Hasid who comes in, and he says to his Rebbe, you know, I am certain that I am going to become a millionaire. How are you so certain? So they just bought a lottery ticket and it pays $1 million, and I know I'm going to win. The Rebbe says, very, very interesting. Tell me, that ticket, do you have it with you? He says, yes, I have it in my pocket, Rebbe. Would you like to see it? Sure. Shows him the ticket. The Rebbe looks at the ticket. He says, I'm interested in giving you $500,000 right now for this ticket. Wow! Great deal! You know, and you see the guy like relieved. He's going to get his money. He says, you're a faker. You were so certain you were going to get $1 million. Well, if you're ready to trade it for $500,000, you're obviously not that certain that you're going to get $1 million. So that issue of certainty is what we need to be. That's why he calls it Hashkatat Rucho Libo. It's an absolute emotional certainty, not just an intellectual awareness that yes, God says he provides, but I know he's going to provide. There's no anxiety about this one. It's a deep emotional feeling. The Beis Halevi actually compares it to a nursing infant who's ready to nurse, who knows that his needs are about to be fulfilled. And it's just right there. And most of the time, we do not have that feeling. We live with enough uncertainty that we do these sabbaths. You know, in theory, if we had that much certainty, we wouldn't go to work at all. I mean, why should we? And why would we be allowed to if we know that God's going to provide? Most of us live without that absolute level of certainty.
You're saying that in contrast to everything that you've been taught in all our lives, that we're not supposed to try to get to a point where we have that certainty for that particular need?
You can, and that's what all the Sfarim are about, is your ability to elevate yourself, and that's all fine.
That inner conflict.
You can, and all that's fine, but the question is, what do I do now until I get to that level? Until I'm on that higher level, what do I do right now? If it's a mitzvah, I'm obligated to live according to B'tachon. So what do I do if I don't have that level? So the six steps say, be honest and make an assessment. So if in step three, you assess that with regard to this particular need, I have complete and utter tranquility, then stop there. Do not do any hishtadlus. Your need is going to be met. You'll see.
So, you're saying, though, in this case, let's say, just this particular case, looking for a job would be unnecessary if you felt...
If you had that certainty. Now, again, I just want to show you what kind of certainty we're talking about. I usually give this as an example. If I'm standing on this side of the room, and my goal, my next interest is to walk from this side of the room to the other side of the room, my next most immediate need is to take a step, and to have it so that when I take that step, Lenny's floor will not collapse underneath my foot. That's my next most immediate need. It really is. Now, I know that it's perfectly possible... nothing to say about Israeli construction. At first, it's completely possible that when I take that step, it will collapse under me. So the question is, if I analyze what I'm doing, as I take that step, am I doing it with trepidation? Am I saying it's tefillas haderech before I take the first step? Or am I not? And the truth is that I'm not. I'm just walking without thinking because it is so natural. That's the kind of hashkret hadrucha levo. We have to be talking about the job prospect to not have to go to step four. Most of us don't have that. It would be great if we can build ourselves up to it. Most of us don't have it. So we go to step four.
What if one spouse has it and the other spouse doesn't?
You need to know who is making the cheshbon. In general, the most classic way that this operates is that a woman relies on her husband, and a husband has to rely on Hashem. It's not always like that. The classic model, and it's a perfectly legitimate model. But you need to know who is doing the approach. One or the other is essentially interacting with Hashem, saying, "I have this need." So it's usually not the couple. In other words, if there's a couple, who has the ultimate responsibility? When a man writes a ketubah, he is taking responsibility for his wife's needs. So he is the one upon whom the responsibility falls. He is the one who's then turning to God and saying, "I have to rely on you because someone's relying on you."
So then she has to rely on him.
In that case. But there are times when this is a need that she has. It's her need. She has a right to rely on her husband for needs that he has committed to her. But there are things that she may need that her husband never committed to. For those, she's dealing directly with God. You need to know in every case who's doing the relying.
But I read that women parnasa comes through the woman of the home. Is that
where the source of bracha, the makor of brachos, Shabbos is the makor of brachos? That's not relevant to this. That's all true. And if I want to strengthen any of the factors that might make a difference in how much Shabbos I have to do, whether these are needs or not needs, go to the source of it, and the source may be the woman, the source may be any of the things that the source is of. But when I come to do the mitzvah, when I have to decide how is it that the Torah wants me to function when I know I have a need, it's not relevant where it comes from, what the zechut comes from. What matters is what are my obligations. So if I don't have hashpat ha'ducha v'liva, I gotta go to step four. Now, four and five are devoted to pinpointing my hishtadlus. Because that's the missing link. Hishtadlus is what we do to close the gap between how I ought to be feeling and how I do feel. When we have that anxiety, we realize that it's not justified. Intellectually, we know that God provides our needs, but somehow I can't seem to get that feeling that I'd like to have, the same feeling that I have when I walk across the floor. I don't have that about my parnasa. That's why there's so many Jews who aren't making aliyah, right? Because, well, yeah, of course God will take care of me if I come, but I don't know if he will. I better have a job, or I better have $2 million so I'll become a millionaire. So there's a gap. Yishtablus closes the gap. And we can see why. Because if a person did enough Yishtablus, he would quit. Even if he had a need. Let's say you have to pay your rent on Thursday and you're a Fuller brush salesman. And so you go knocking on doors to sell Fuller brushes. If you were to sit on Monday and figure out how many doors am I going to knock on between now and Thursday to guarantee myself, the person wasn't using God and be tough of it, how many doors would I knock on before I would just quit and say, you know, I've done enough effort, somehow this money is going to come. 1,000 doors. And there's some upper limit. And then the guy would just quit and say, you know something, I've done enough. Everybody has that ceiling. Even if they don't know that God's going to provide them. Step four is, for this need, what's my ceiling? Step four is, what is the most that I could project myself doing to have this need met? Everybody has needs, and everybody's out there working in the world to get their needs met. But everybody has an upper limit. There's a quitting point for everybody. So step four is, for this particular need, for who I am, for the efforts that I would be putting in, what's my ceiling? What's the most that I would do to find this need? Now, I like to give examples that are not always about panasa, because there's so many needs that we have. My favorite example, well, the most common example, and I do this with my kids all the time, is a lost backpack for school, because they're always losing their backpack. And, so I say, well, do you need it? Yeah. You know, is it a pasuk? No. Is it a chazal? No. It's derech ha'olam, because everybody in my class needs their notebook in school. Okay, fine. So it's a need. I mean, God's going to provide it to you. Well, do you just understand that it's going to come now that you've identified the need? No, they're anxious about it. Fine. So, you know, what's the most that you would look? Well, I've already looked all over everywhere in the house. Okay, but let's just step back for a minute and imagine if you hadn't done any looking yet at all, but all you know is that you need to find your notebook and you don't know where it is. What's the most that you could imagine? How many times could you imagine yourself searching the house before you just quit and say, that's it, I'm not looking anymore? So, they'll say, you know, like 5 times. And it's true. They would never search the house more than 5 times, even if they needed the notebook and couldn't find it. So step four is, what's my upper limit?
Are you using the normalcy standard, derech olam, for the 5 times, or that's purely subjective?
It's subjective, but it doesn't matter, because we're just maximizing. We're just worst-casing it. Step five is, okay, so the most that you would do is search the house 5 times. But think for a second. You know, I'll tell this to my kids. You've already decided that it's something you need, which means Hashem has already accepted that you need this. If you need it, Hashem's going to provide it for you, which means he knows exactly where it is, and he's going to give it to you. You're the only one who's causing him to delay. Now, do you think, since he knows where it is, and he's just waiting to open your eyes, you think he needs to hang around waiting for you to walk 5 times throughout the house before he'll open your eyes and show you where it is? He already knows that he's got to give it to you. Well, no, not really. And then, of course, they go to the other extreme and say, well, I'll just check in my bedroom. And then I turn around and I say, step five has to be done with a chavrusa. And I say to them, so you think you and God are so tight that all you have to do is just look around in 1 or 2 closets and he's going to magically show you that notebook? Well, no, maybe. Okay, 4 times. And I go back and forth until we come up with an amount that my kid says to himself, that sounds reasonable. It's the amount that if I project having done that, I know that I'll be able to feel that I've done enough and Hashem can show me where it is. And it's an incredible thing. You can pinpoint this feeling specifically with the chavrusa. It's hard to do it with that one. And so you go back and forth and you try to understand what is it. And you're analyzing your relationship with Hashem while you do it. What is he going to be holding out for? At what point is he going to say, listen, Sachkala, you know, you don't have to do all those things. I already know where it is. You already know that I'm going to give it to you. You want to do some effort. That much effort you need to do. There is a point where you'll say, yeah, I guess you're right. Now, what's fascinating about this is that any amount of effort that you've put in prior to making a cheshbon does not count. It doesn't count. And I've had situations where my kids have said, but I've looked everywhere in the house already. And they have. I said, true, but you didn't do it inside of a cheshbon. So let's make a cheshbon. So they will. And they'll say, okay, I have to check 3 rooms. I'll say, fine. And they'll wander off and they'll say, but I already checked these 3 rooms. And they'll go into the rooms and one of two things will happen. Either they'll find the notebook in one of those rooms in a place that they just didn't happen to notice it the first time, or the notebook will be somewhere else. But after they check the 3 rooms, they'll discover where the notebook is. The dog will bring it in from the backyard. Hashem doesn't need to use your particular method that you carved out for him. He knows where it is, and he's going to get it to you, because he committed himself to getting it to you. He's waiting for you to do your status. So you do your status, and he will provide it from wherever he wants to provide it. Step 5 is where you make another psak halacha. And after you go back and forth with the chavrusa, and you have convinced him that this is an honest assessment inside of you, that says, this is the amount of hishtadlus that will make me feel comfortable with God opening my eyes to where the need is, you issue a psak, and that is your chiyuv hishtadlus. No more, no less. God can provide it to you before you finish exercising it, but that is the quantification of your chiyuv. You paskin it, and that makes it real.
Can your spouse be your chavruta?
It's difficult. Because he's so kagufa. It's the same bias that you have. It's very, very good. I don't recommend it.
So wait, explain number 5 again.
Number 5 is you start with step 4. Step 4, you put up your ceiling, the most possible hishtadlus that you could imagine yourself doing in this situation. Step 5, you get real about it and you say, yeah, but there's no reason why God should wait for me to do all that hishtadlus when he already knows where it is and he already has committed himself to giving it to me. On the other hand, I don't think I can do nothing because I don't have that feeling that I need to have. So I project, as I discuss with my chavrusa, how much hishtadlus would make me feel that in my relationship with God, my understanding of myself vis-a-vis how he sees me, that amount of hishtadlus would make me feel like I've done enough. And you pinpoint it exactly. And then you make a ruling.
Can I be cynical for a moment?
Please.
So let's take a job again. I have a family and a wife who I committed to support. My family. I don't know that there's any ceiling on getting a job. If I didn't have a job, I would search for a job until I found a job. My status would be right out there and finding that job.
See, you wouldn't. It's not true. You could, in theory, look for a job 24 hours a day, but you won't. At some point, you're going to come home that day, and you're going to say, you know what? I'm going to sleep. And not just because you're falling asleep, because you say, it's not possible that I have to work this hard to get this need. We all have that ceiling.
Okay, and then step 5, cynicism. So what if my feeling is that, you know, my relationship with God, I probably have to do everything.
Your chavrusa won't let you get away with it. We err on both ends. We err by thinking that we are less important to God than we are, and we err by thinking that we're more important to God than we are. And that's the chavrusa. You can't get it by a good chavrusa. You have to get a person.
You buy one of these chavrusas.
That's my need.
I have a rate, so you can use to meet the rate.
Can you just pick like a middle number randomly?
Well, you start with that, but if you're going to have to convince somebody. I almost went to law school before I decided to stay and become a rabbi, so use me, I'm going to grill you. But you have to convince somebody that it's genuine. So you can start by picking something out of the air, but if it isn't real, you're not going to get a pastor for a person. Mm-hmm. Yes?
You said if given amount, it can be given early, but the amount is still an obligatory amount to give.
That is your obligation.
You still have to give more after the
after you get it? No. Once you get it, the game is, it's really a game in a sense. It's only we that ask God, please let us do something to feel part of it. He doesn't need any of it. So once he's given us the thing, it's over. Yes?
Okay. In Shidduch, I would like to be married. Okay?
I gave up dating because I became terrified of the dating process. Some of the men I met were clearly dangerous people. And I said, God, I literally said, Hashem, I'm giving it over to you. I can't deal with this. It's your job. I'm still waiting. It's decades later.
Okay, so which part of it would we be able to define as the need? Now again,
okay,
the building
normal.
The relationship is avodah. So
okay.
Which?
So it's normal. It's normal to be married. Okay.
Right. I'm
okay.
Convinced of that. But
okay.
Now, by the way, not for the same reason that it would be if you were a man. Because if you were a man, you'd be able to quote a pasuk. But the pasuk says, lo tov hayot ha'adam levado.
Right, but a woman is a giver. We give.
So
I have no one to give to.
So you could say that the derech ha'olam is
right.
That you need to be married. But you can't say that it's the same pasuk. The man will be
no.
Able to quote a different automatic.
Right. Right.
So, okay.
I'm
so what is the need? So let's define the need.
My need is to be giving, to be involved in a relationship, and to be giving to somebody.
No, that's what you want to do. That is your objective. That is your aspiration.
Okay.
What need do you have in order to be able to realize that aspiration?
I need someone to give to.
Okay. Well, in that case, you'll need someone to build a relationship with.
Right.
The building of the relationship is your own effort. That's, again, your aspiration. So what's the need?
Find a person to build a relationship with.
Find a person with whom you can see whether there's a relationship to be built.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. If you need to say that I need to find somebody who's not a dangerous person, I think that's a perfectly legitimate need. But you have to define the need very specifically and very carefully.
Okay.
Because that need is what you will paskin. That need is what Hashem is.
Well, I have spelled it out to Hashem.
Well, let me give you a couple of caveats.
Okay.
What you're describing can be perfectly put into the system, and until it is put into the system, you cannot explain why or why not you haven't been answered. The system is the way that we access our performance of this mitzvah and Hashem's promise to give us our needs. This system will work. The system always works. The system cannot fail. Let me just explain what step six is and then I'll get back to you. Step six is after we have step five, we have a psak halacha, and step five, this is what our establish is. Step six is just to crystallize what we meant in step five. So when my kids say, okay, I got to check three rooms, I say, which rooms? Okay, there's my bedroom and the living room and the porch. And what do you mean by check? You're going to open up all the closets? Are you going to uncover all of the boxes? You're going to look under all the beds? Tell me exactly what you meant when you said you were going to check three rooms. So step six is just crystallizing step five. And you write it down on paper, and then you have your Mishnah Berurah. You have your specifics. Those are your Hilchot Hishtadlut. That's what you now have to do to do your end. Now, let me get back to the biggest caveat that I use when I teach this. I don't recommend starting out on your biggest need. Not because it won't work, because it will. And it'll freak you out. Because the reality of this is overwhelming. And so I tell people, I recommend to people strongly to start with small needs. Lost notebooks.
But actually, the first step is this my next most immediate need.
That's true. But
so there can only be one.
And that's not true. Because I can bypass a need and the next one will be my next most immediate need. In other words, I can't work on a need that isn't my next most immediate need, but if there is one, I can bypass it. The one that I'm working on has to be one that there's nothing in between. So I can wait till I get a good starter need, and I recommend it strongly. For example, parking spaces is a good one. Parking spaces in certain cities, it's a real need, and it comes up regularly, and you need it because you've got to get in and get out. You can use this for parking spaces. It works incredibly. I'll tell you stories. You know, where I needed to be at a certain place by a certain time. I had a court appearance. I had to be there by a certain time. The place was jammed. There were cars in every spot. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. No one's going to be pulling out. But I needed a spot, so God had to provide me one. So I made a cheshbon. I said, okay, my hishtadlus is I'm going to circle this block 3 times. And I did. And on the third time, as I'm driving up, I see somebody pull out. Just where I needed, and I was able to get in on time to my meeting. That's how precise it is. It's a little frightening to have this happen all the time, but it will happen every time you try it. I don't.
That means you can do it without the perverse, though.
Yeah.
Like on a
regular basis. Well, I can because I've done this for so many years. What I tell people who are starting is, you know, get your chavrusa on notice that you may call them at short notice to do it. For something like a parking space, maybe you can do it already. You know,
try some.
Usually what I like to do it once first with a new recruit, just to make sure that I feel confident that they've got it and they know what to do. But yeah, in theory, if your bias isn't that strong and you really think that you can make an honest assessment, you could do it yourself. But it's like a muscle. If you have a heavy box to lift and you haven't used your muscles in a while, you may lift it, but it's going to have, there's going to be recoil. And so I really recommend strongly that people bypass their biggest needs for a little while and test it out and work it out on small things, and then get bigger and bigger and bigger as you see it work, as you see the consistency, as you start to learn how to assess correctly. You'll know when you're ready, or I can certainly help assess with you with whether you're ready to go to higher.
Without having met you and knowing these six steps, I once, quote, accidentally proved that your system is correct. Several years ago, I had been diagnosed as blind, and it was a very sudden occurrence, what happened, and there was no hope that I would see. And I told the doctors, I see a better future. You're wrong. Okay. So I had surgery and then I had therapy, and they told me the day before Rosh Hashanah, there's nothing we can do. You're not going to see again. And I said, I told you. You're wrong. And I slammed the door. Oh, I said, hold that thought. And then I slammed the door. I'll see you next year, you know, as I'm leaving the door. And I came back next year and they did the exams. I see in color and I see in depth. And the prescription keeps going down, and now I'm going on my 15th prescription in 4 years. It just keeps going down. And the doctors are not convinced that they will come. I'll see without glasses.
So that's a wonderful illustration of the certainty that I was talking about, the Hashkata's Ruach HaLibo. It doesn't tell me much about Hishtadlus.
I skipped the process.
And because in so many of these cases, right, we're not going to have that feeling. In your case, you had it. And so many needs that we have, we aren't going to have that. We can get tripped up on either side, either on the assessment of our feeling or on the pinpointing our Hishtadlus. But I'll tell you the story that sold me on this after I had spent, I guess it was probably 8 years developing it and refining it. And then I had the following incident that occurred to me, and that's when I knew that I was right. I was in yeshiva, and that summer I hung around the yeshiva. I was taking some courses, and I decided to stay in the dorm. And I hung around the yeshiva, and there was one of the chavrei kolo who had been offered the opportunity to have his own yeshiva in a different city that fall. And the requirement was that he had to provide six students to make up the nucleus of the new yeshiva. So it was the beginning of the summer, and I see him in the Beis Medrash one day, and I went over to him. I just said, hi, how are you? I heard that you're looking to start a new yeshiva. Do you have any of the buffering that you need? He says, no, I don't have any. I said, well, what are you planning to do? He says, well, next week I'm planning a trip to the Catskills. I'm going to go to the camps, the summer camps, and meet with guys, and I'll try to find guys. I said, great. So I bid him goodbye, and a week later, I see him back in the Beis Medrash, and he's got a beaming face. He's got a smile. His face is literally beaming. I go over to him. I say, hi, how are you? You back from the mountains? He says, yes. I said, so were you successful? He says, absolutely. I said, how many buffering did you get? He said, none. I said, so why are you so happy? He said, because I know that I did a fabulous Hishtadlus. I didn't waste a minute on my trip. I got up early in the morning. I spoke with guys all day long until late at night. I know that I did a great Hishtadlus. 1 week later, he had six buffering and he was able to open the yeshiva. Not one of the six was from his trip to the mountains. And that's when I realized that this is for real.
But he didn't do the process, right?
No, but
it's a natural process.
I think many people do this naturally. Right. And I think all the people in Yerushalayim line that I couldn't figure out how they live, I think they all do it naturally.
It's like the Chabad thing of think good and it will be good. If you actually, in your mind, see, like, let's say you lost your keys. You see that you're going to find your key, and you have it's a lot of work, and you do have to feel a certain feeling of serenity about it, because even if you have that little anxiety, that could blow the whole thing. But if you see it and you relax about it, and you know you're going to find it, you'll find it.
But again, so much of that is true, but so much of that is on the first half.
Well,
and
you don't
neglects,
need the second half if you
if
have
you
that.
If you have it, that's true, but I think it's rare. And I think
it's hard.
And it can't be a mitzvah if only some of us can access it. A mitzvah is an obligation. The Or Yisrael says in his introduction that bitachon is a mitzvah that applies to everybody, whether he is a tzaddik or a rasha. A rasha?
Yeah.
That means if a person is a thief and he's breaking and entering into your house and he says, God, I have bitachon in you that I won't be caught, and he does it properly, God will respond and make sure he doesn't get caught. That's what the Or Yisrael says. This is not limited to big tzaddikim. Mm-hmm. We all have to live with bitachon. But in order to do that, we've got to assess where we are, and we have to be prepared to make a calculation for how much yishalos we have to do.
Could it be like a more ephemeral need, like I want my children to be successful in their schools in Israel so that they'll be happy with having...
You said the magic word. You said, I want. That's a want, not a need.
But I need them to be happy in their school so that the Aliyah can be successful.
Then you want that.
It's just
now, they may need it. Let them come and do it.
Uh-huh.
You're the
mom. You can't
mom.
Want for somebody else.
You want
okay.
it, not
but
need.
I did
want
to say something about like real bitachon is getting pregnant. Like that you have bitachon that you're going to have a healthy baby. Right? I mean, it's such a leap of faith to get pregnant and to like hope that your baby will be healthy, but most people do this and believe that God will help them have a good delivery and healthy baby.
I would argue that if there is a woman who doesn't, perhaps she has to get each time.
Uh-huh.
And let her make a calculation how much she starts.
Most women pray when they're pregnant that a baby...
And I'm not sure that she could convince me that it's a need either.
Baby?
I think she wants to have a healthy baby. Yeah, you could try. I'm not sure you could convince me.
Can you talk a little bit more about how to differentiate needs and wants? And also, you had mentioned at the beginning about praying and tefillah. Because I'm like, if I have a need for health, which I don't think is a want or desire, like to have, you know, right? I mean, that's a need. But I pray for it daily in Rishlayinu. And so how do I begin?
The daily prayers, the Shemona Esrei, the daily Rishlayinu, is not an act of Shabbos. The daily tefillah is an act of acknowledgement that refuah comes from God. It's not saying, I better daven today for refuah so I'll be healthy today. That's really not what it is, and Chazal will tell us that that's not what it is. There's another form of tefillah.
You're saying that it's the Rambam's perspective that I'm talking to myself, I'm reminding myself where it comes.
Either I'm reminding myself, but more importantly, I'm not. That's why it's daily. That's why it's regular. What if I don't need health today? Or what if I'm not worried about it? That's not what that is. Daily tefillah is a daily acknowledgement. It's posturing. It says, "I'm the one who gets the healing. You're the one who provides it." It's really a different concept. But there are people who specifically pray for things they need. You remember Moshe on the banks of the Yam Suf? God said, "Stop praying. Cross, because now is not the time."
So if you can talk a little bit about the needs versus wants aspect of it.
So there's not a lot to talk about because it's all about your chavrusa. Unless you have an automatic, you can think that you have a need. Just get someone to challenge you. It's really very, very personal.
Everyone would agree that health is a need, though.
You have to serve a Hashem. You need to be healthy to serve a Hashem.
No, you don't.
What aspect of it?
I mean,
is the need?
You don't need it, but you
see, there's already someone who's ready to make a challenge. So first of all, you could get a challenge on it, and second of all, I think in a particular case, when we're talking about a need, you're going to be more specific anyway. Is health your next most immediate need?
Yeah.
You have nothing else on your plate right now except the health for the rest of your life. Now, you may say, you know, I need my blood pressure to be lower. That's a specific health need. Mm-hmm. Then we can talk about it. I think that's the way to get through that. Yes?
Can you think of an example where the thief's bitachon is in conflict with the homeowner's bitachon, where is it possible to have an example where both are using
the
foolproof
method?
Yeah, of course.
The thief doesn't want to be caught. The homeowner has a need not to be stolen from. So the way it'll work out if both have done it properly is that the thief will make his way in, find nothing to steal, and make his way out safely. You know.
Or the homeowner will wake up, frighten the guy away, and
he'll get out without it, and then everybody's needs are met.
And the sickness that you mentioned by the youngster, I had already written down Nachshon. Is there anything by Nachshon?
Nachshon is doing an avoda. That's no longer in the category of needs. That is his avoda, Sasha. To walk into. Yeah.
That's not an example of
the
need.
Why is the thief a need, not a want?
The thief?
I'm having a really hard time with this need want business.
He needs to get out. He needs to not be caught. He absolutely does. What is his service? What is his ambition? Remember, the needs are the logistical, material, and or emotional needs that I have in order to realize my ambition. What's the thief's ambition?
Steal.
Just to provide himself some money, right? That's his ambition, to steal. In order to do that, he's got to be able to get out without being caught. That's an absolute
so
need.
So his need can support a not yashar.
And they are absolutely right, because they operate on separate tracks.
Uh-huh.
They operate on completely separate tracks. I'll just tell you, you know, one or two stories, and then I don't know if you want to go into any more details of
our... I can tell you the story.
But I'll tell you one. This was a great... I taught this to a group of high school students, ninth graders, mostly girls. And they were buzzing about it for days, and I kept on telling them, you know, you got to find a case where you can try it, because I won't let my students start out with big things, and high school girls, everything is a big thing, but really nothing is a big thing. So, but one of them called me, came to school one morning, all excited, because she had done it the night before, and she had to share with me what happened. She had committed herself to babysit. And she got a call from a friend who was having a party. And she wanted to go, and she calculated. She actually concluded that she needed to go to the party. She had reasons why it was a necessity. And high school girls have a lot of needs. And she realized that she had just learned the system and that I'm pushing them to find places to try it. So she called another girl in the class. And she said, "Will you be my chavrusa? I want to said me because I have a commitment to this babysitting job, but I really need to go to this party." So the other girls read, and she calculated that she needed to find a replacement for herself to take the babysitting job, and that she would need, she would call 10 friends. That was her Hishtadlus calculation in step 5. She was going to call 10 friends, and she projected, if I call 10 friends, I'll quit, because that's really what I believe that Hashem is waiting for me, and since I need it, he's going to provide it. She called 10 friends, they all turned her down. She was about to go to the babysitting job, and probably complained to me the next day. When the phone rang, and it was the woman she was going to babysit for. "Oh, I'm so terribly sorry. I know that you're on your way over here, and I promised you the babysitting job, but my niece just came in unexpectedly from out of town. She's here in the house. I really don't need you." She was delirious. And she was so excited when she came into school. And this is consistent. This is not a system that can fail. It's I got to tell you, it's just incredible.
Sometimes in my experience, I find that I don't even have a need, but it's just that I want something, and Hashem just gives it to me.
That is completely real. It's realistic, it's reasonable. People have that experience all the time. It has nothing to do with what I'm talking about tonight.
I know.
And it's perfectly, I mean, that is, we have,
that's
what I said. We have a relationship with God. Every one of us has a relationship with God. We are more aware of it or less aware of it. We are more involved in running it or less, but we all have a relationship.
I find this six-step system, I'm a mathematical person, but I find it little bit too analytical, too complicated for me. And I want to be simpler. I want to be more like Zusha. Okay?
Great.
And was Zusha, I suppose he was doing the mitzvah of bitachon. He says, I want, I'm hungry.
He was using the six steps. He was using the six steps, never got past step three. Never needed to go past step three.
He wasn't aware of your
system. He was. He may not have defined it, but he lived it. And that's why I say I think there are many people who live it naturally. But for those of us who don't have it naturally, I find that having it spelled out in this fashion is extraordinarily valuable.
I
want to
be
more
efficient.
Yes.
You only have like very vague ideas of what you think you might need, and you don't have any specific anything that you're trying to work for.
It's you need to grow, and so that's why it's spiritual growth that we're talking about. That's why I suggest people start find a specific thing. I have had people who have found it hard to find something to apply it to. But if you put some effort into it, and you make yourself aware, when am I going to find a situation where there's a specific enough need that I have that I can apply the system? You will find it. I mean, we have barei nefashot rabot b'chesronah. God created us with needs. You'll find one.
Yeah, like she was saying, there's many times in the past where I've been, whether it's parking or searching to buy something, where I said in my mind, I have to get this thing. But I did not make any chavrusa calculation, and I got it. And I even thanked Hashem, so thanks, But there was no cheshbon.
Right.
I said I need it.
Isn't it nice to know that you can actually move into the driver's seat?
Yeah, I'm trying to get that with, a job and other things, too.
But it will, you build it up. And if on those simple cases, the small cases... The
simple cases works.
If you start doing a cheshbon with it... For example, if I wanted to really grab you and train you, I would tell you to start using the six steps for your next breath of air. By step three, you'd be done. But I would get you used to the concept that we're actually doing this all the time. Because once I get you used to the idea that we do this all the time, then you can start doing it deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start growing. And then you can start using it for bigger and bigger and bigger needs. I did this with Lenny. Lenny, you can...
I got licensing to the Beatles...
Stand
up? Yeah. I'll just give you a quick first thing, because I've used it to rent minivans at the National Rental Car twice, where I paid for an economy car, and I made a cheshbon flying in on a plane that my most immediate need, I did it myself without a chavrusa, my most immediate need was to rent a minivan for the same price as an economy car, because minivan was three times the price, because it was Christmas vacation, and also I had to transport Eitan G and my drummer with all the equipment. And I made a cheshbon that my most immediate need was to rent the minivan. I said my ishtadlus was I'm going to take the air train to National Rent-A-Car. I'm going to look at the cars on the lot. I'm going to then see, because I'm an Emerald Isle guy, so I can take, they have a selection of cars that I can take for the price of a regular mid-sized car. I said, I'm going to see if there's any big cars on that aisle. There were none. I said, my ishtadlus is going to be, I'm going to go in to talk to somebody there and ask them to authorize me either an SUV or a minivan. Both times, they did. They were, okay, so I've used it for parking spaces, but for the big one was the Beatles thing. So I was with Rabbi Goldberger in Minneapolis on November 8th. He asked me why the Beatles album hadn't come out yet. I told him God said no. He said no, you put barriers there. We did the six steps. We came to the conclusion that my most immediate need was that God had to lift the barriers of this Beatles album in order for me to be able to release it. Third step was, do I have a pure belief that he's just going to give it to me without me doing anything? I did not. I made a list of five things that I would do in order for the Hishtadlus to work, for step four, what the Hishtadlus was. The five things were, send an email to Nancy Chevelle, who's Paul McCartney's girlfriend, call my entertainment lawyer and see if anything has changed, call up, go to Stella McCartney's shop in Manhattan to try to speak to her to get permission that way, talk to Akum Israel. Akum Israel is the copyright publishing place. That's the fourth thing. And the fifth thing was to send a CD sampler to Paul McCartney's
publishing company to try to get permission again. They had said no to me in June 2008. So he took a look at that list. He said, okay, these are the list of five things. If you did not believe in the, if you did not believe in the Bitachon rules, these are the five things that you would do. This is your ceiling. He said, but you do believe in it, so pick two things. I said, two is too little. So he said, okay, pick three things. So I picked three things that were my ishtadlus. One was to go to Stella McCartney's shop. One was to call up the Aquam Israel, the licensing place in Israel, and try to get licensing that way. And the third thing was to send a CD sampler to Paul McCartney. Okay, the next day I got back to New York. I went to Stella McCartney's shop in New York. I walked in. I said, can I speak to Stella McCartney? They rolled their eyes. They said, she's in London. She's never here. I said, if I left my card, would she call me? They said, no. I said, thank you very much. I walked out. Because Rabbi Goldberger said, you don't have to speak to her. You just have to go to the shop. Your ishtadlus is to go to the shop and ask to speak to her. So that's what I did. That was step one. Step two is I got back to Israel. I called up Aquam on November 18th, which was the day after I got back, which was one on my schedule. And I said, I have a project called Shabbat in Liverpool, 27 Beatles songs. I'd like to get licensing. They said, fine. They sent me paperwork. I called up Rabbi Goldberger. I emailed Rabbi Goldberger. I said, they just sent me paperwork. Maybe I shouldn't send a CD sampler to Paul McCartney because it's going to conflict. He said, no, that's your ishtadlus. You have to do three things. Send the CD sampler. So I sent the CD sampler. In the meantime, Aquam Israel had sent me a letter in early November before I left to go to Minneapolis. And that letter said, Israel copyright law has been changed. If you take somebody else's song and you put Hebrew words to it, you no longer need their permission. You can now just pay licensing, pay royalties, and you are now co-licensing owners with them. You just have to pay them licensing in order to press the CDs. So I have a 9-page document upstairs that I received on December 24th, which I paid for with a credit card over the phone, and it says, The Long and Winding Road, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, Lenny Solomon. I am a co-licensor with the Beatles for 27 songs, and I have permission to press 1,500 CDs for an album called Shabbat in Liverpool that's going to come out.
Do we get a sample tonight?
I've been playing on the piano. But the point is, it's being mixed. As soon as he told me, when I was there in Minneapolis, he said to me, I guarantee you this will be given to you, and when it's given to you, don't be surprised. And not only was it given to me, it was given to me basically before I left. Because had I translated the letter that Aquam had sent to me before I left for America on my trip, I would have seen that publishing laws had changed in Israel. Now, even though in New York, in the U.S. and in the U.K., they have not changed, because there's an agreement with the U.S. and the U.K., the contract specifically states from Aquam Israel that I can release this anywhere in the world and I can manufacture it anywhere in the world. And that was the story. So basically, if you want to be technical, November 8th was when I met with him, and December 24th I got licensing. It took a month and 16 days. But the truth is,
What happened with the CD sampler?
I haven't heard anything, because you don't hear anything from them. It took me 3.5 years for them to respond to me. And the Kraz, of course, who's sitting over there, would say, well, why did you ask in the first place? The answer is, I don't know. Because I didn't listen to the Kraz.
You couldn't just put this thing out?
I could have put it out. My entertainment lawyer said, put it out. You'll get sued for $10 million of 23 willful copyright violations, and I want the legal fees. That's what he said to me. He said, put it out, make my day. I want some real legal fees. The answer is, it was a violation of copyright law because it was not a song parody, it was an adaptation. Because it was an adaptation, I needed the permission of the writers. I had Michael Jackson and Sony ATV National ready to sign a licensing agreement pending on the permission of the estate of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And they said no on June 16th, 2008, the day that I call Black Monday. So that was what happened. But in 1 month, through the six steps of Bitachon, it got turned around. And that's why,
How is it a need, Letty, if it's not a pasuk and it's not Derech HaOlam?
Because
those are just the automatics.
One of the things Rabbi Goldberger said to me, is your music Bitachon or is it Avoda? So remember, why is a Jew created? Rabbi Goldberger told me this. A Jew is created to serve Hashem. That's why we're put on this earth, to serve Hashem, right? So everybody's got their avoda, everybody's got their tafkid. Now, he asked me, is my music, is schlock rock service to God, or is it my parnasa? Is it my technical, emotional, material needs? Now, I always thought, for the last 24 years, that this business, schlock rock, is a business. And that any kirov that it does is secondary. It's a side effect. But what I came to the conclusion after thinking about it was, I never would have gone into schlock rock for a living. When I made that schlock rock album in 1986, it was a joke. It was supposed to be a one album fad. I did it because I wanted to play rock and roll with guys and change the words. It was not out to do cure, but it was only till 9 months later when I got a letter from a lady that said, my non-religious brother who hates everything about Judaism is listening to your album around the clock. Keep up the good work. And then I thought to myself, oh, maybe that's what this is for. And then a whole career developed from it, and that's what I've been doing for the last 24 years. I'm making a living and supporting my family. I thought that that was my parnasa, and it's not my parnasa, it's my avoda. So all the schlock rock albums are avoda. So once we ascertained that the albums were avoda, and that I had placed a barrier in front of this album, and it wasn't that God said no, it was that I didn't want it to come out, for whatever reason, which actually was true, because of the flack that I'm probably going to get when it comes out, and the flack that I got before, and as I was making it from different people in the music business, whatever, but the point of the matter is, once we ascertained that it was, I had placed the barrier, that this was a boda, he could then say that it was my most immediate need for the barriers to be released in order for the album to come out. And that took a 2-hour meeting. It was a 2-hour meeting that we had on November 8th. And at the end of that 2-hour meeting, we made a psak din, that this was my ishtadlus, this was my most immediate need, this was my ishtadlus, and it happened like water. It was the most unbelievable thing. And it happens all the time on smaller things with me. Now we're working on my next most immediate need, which I haven't figured out, which we're just about getting. But
I want to thank you all for taking your time and coming to hear me tonight. If anybody is interested in reviewing it, it is online. There's an MP3 on thefoundationstone.org, which and just go and search under Bitachon or under Goldberger, and it'll come up.
The foundation.
Thefoundationstone.org. Mm-hmm. The recording is not that great, but you can review it.
And I'm just MP3 the entire shiur, and so is Ruben. So.
Questions.
So Avodah is considered a need.
Avodah is not. Avodah is Bitachon is the logistic material and possibly emotional needs that you have, those needs that you have in order to be able to do your avodah. You designate
the
avodah.
That was avodah.
Right. So in other words, his perception is that his service to God is putting out these albums. In order to put out this album, he had certain logistical needs that had to be met. That's what he is perfecting.
I'm just curious, what do you think is the secret? Well, how do you? Do you know about the secret?
I'm not that familiar with it.
Okay. It's supposedly taking stuff that's in Kabbalah and Jewish sources. That's what they said, the woman that did it. Think about it, focus on it, and you'll get it.
I have a natural skepticism towards towards today's Kabbalists' ability to pull off the things that they purport to pull off.
That was one thing she found.
And quick fixes. I have a natural resistance to them. And the only reason why I've gone as far with this as I've gone is because it seems to me that it is a mitzvah that we're obligated to. So we don't have a choice. Thank you so much.
You guys are all invited to birthday cake.